Repeat after me, everybody. This is not 2008. This is not 2008. It's scary and it's weird, but it's not 2008. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, the 25th day of August. Great as always to have you with us, everybody. I get it. I really do. It's been a bananas couple of days out there. The stock market's doing who knows what, up or down a couple of hundred points every time you turn around. China leading the European markets down, Europe leading Wall Street lower, and then today here, up 300 points on the Dow, and then it closed down 205. What the heck? It's a lot like the last time this happened. Except it's not. It's really not. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman gets us going.
Remember those crazy, panicky days of late summer 2008? It was day after day of market drops, kind of like what we've seen this week. But that's where the resemblance ends. Let me refresh your memory. Lehman and Washington Mutual go belly up. The government seizes Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. The big three automakers and the big banks line up for bailouts. We haven't seen anything like that this time around, says Paul Ashworth at Capital Economics.
What we've had over the last few days is a drop back in equity prices, but we haven't seen any sign of a credit crunch. Certainly banks are still freely lending to other banks, which of course was the big problem during the financial crisis.
After two down days this week, the stock market still looks pretty shaky, but Ashworth says the underlying economy remains strong.
The unemployment rate has come down substantially. A lot more people are employed. Domestic sectors of the economy, including even housing, look like they're finally coming back.
And the strength of the U.S. economy relative to weaker ones around the world points out another difference this time around, says finance professor Cornelius Hurley at Boston University.
This crisis is generated through China and Greece and other foreign venues, so it seems somewhat remote.
Of course, we're still connected to Europe and China and other emerging markets through imports and exports and investment flows. A global slowdown could slow us down as well, which would be kind of normal, says policy analyst Gordon Gray at the American Action Forum.
It just so happens that the Great Recession is our most recent memory of a big economic slowdown, but the law of the business cycle is that at some point you're going to see some contraction.
And Gray says not every contraction is a once-in-a-lifetime economic crash. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
So, about China and its stock market, the proximate cause of all the ups and downs the past week or so. The Shanghai Composite dropped another 7.6% today, even as interest rates were cut over there for the fifth time since November, by the way, which did absolutely nothing to calm fears about a slowing economy or the Chinese government's ability to handle said economy. But hang on a second, all right? Because as Marketplace's Sabri Benishul reports, there are some things you need to know about the Chinese market.
We might as well start at the beginning of China's stock market.
When they created the market 25 years ago, they just thought, oh, look, Western economies have stock markets. We should have a stock market.
Scott Kennedy is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. But the stock market they created was kind of a pretend stock market.
The purpose of China's stock market is to raise capital for state-owned enterprises and other privileged companies.
The purpose was not, as it is elsewhere, to let buyers and sellers freely assess the health of companies. And the government has managed the stock market accordingly. For example, last year it told people to go invest in the stock market, says Alan Robinson, vice president at RBC Wealth Management.
Investors thought that they were getting a free ride from the government.
When officials then said they were going to take their hands off the market, people lost confidence.
And that has caused the meltdown that we've seen over the last few sessions.
And when things started going bad, that's when the Communist Party's gloves really came off. They started buying stocks to prop up the market.
The parallel would be if the U.S. Treasury or the Federal Reserve stepped in to purchase the stocks of IBM or of Apple.
Matthew Slaughter is dean of the Tuck School of Business. And the government did not stop there. It prohibited selling until the market reached a certain level and literally threatened to arrest people who were shorting stocks.
The broader problem the Chinese government has created with these interventions is setting the expectations that stock prices can go and should go only up.
Now, despite all of this, China's stock markets have potential. Jennifer Carpenter is associate professor of finance at the Stern School.
we find that against all odds, China's stock prices are surprisingly informative about future corporate earnings.
Otherwise put, China's stock market can be a real stock market if the government would just let it. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Having just laid out the case for why this isn't 2008 all over again, and it's not, I need you to take the following with the big picture held firmly in your minds. The Dow closed down almost 1.3% today, 205 points, but that was a 600-point tumble from its highs of the day. We'll have the details, gory as they may be, when we do the numbers. About the last thing you need if you're running a business in this economy is a week like the past week or so has been. Even though we are 6 years past the Great Recession, a recovery that's been too slow by half starts to feel a little bit at risk. We talk to Lisa Goldenberg from time to time to get a little bit of small business ground truth. She's the president of the Delaware Steel Company of Pennsylvania. We got her on the line again. Lisa, good to talk to you again.
Great to be here.
So broadly speaking, how's business?
I'll give it a fair. I'll give it a B, B minus, could always be better. We're still in recovery period. You and I have been talking for a couple of years now. And recovery, good recovery, takes a long time, years, 10 years.
10 years, so really?
It really does. Because when you're coming off of such a shaky foundation, we had a lot of big adjusting to do. And we had a really solid fall. So as we've spoken, you don't want to just shoot right up on growth. It has to be a slow progression. So to be back where you need to be, it takes a long time.
How much are you keeping an eye on China, right? I mean, that's the news of the day, the slowdown over there, what they're trying to do. Is that a big factor for you?
Well, China's a big factor every day. The new news, if we want to call it new, is not particularly new to me. The way the Chinese operate is sort of full court press and then rein it in. Full court press and then rein it in. So we've been anticipating this pullback. I can't say I anticipated a full devaluation of currency or the drama of it all, but the Chinese is the largest steel producing market in the world. So, you know, I'm watching it every day.
Yeah. Let me tick through a couple of things and you tell me whether they're working for you or against you. The value of the U.S. dollar, the strong currency, it's way up now.
Against me.
Yeah, in a big way.
In a big way. I am, for my daily business, a proponent of a much weaker dollar. I understand some of the advantages in a broader sense, but for my business, it rocks my world. Hmm. I am a big exporter of what's referred to as secondary or off-prime material to third world countries all over the world. And I have zero business, not a little, zero, when the dollar is strong.
Okay, cost of shipping and freight. Oil's down, so it's got to be cheaper for you, yeah?
Not really. In the United States, there are so many other factors to shipping across this country than the cost of fuel. We want our drivers to be insured. We want the roads to be safe. We want drivers to be certified and have proper resting times and have way stations and all the things that we're used to in a developed, sophisticated economy, and those things are very, very expensive.
Last question, and this is, it's way more subjective, not just a little bit more subjective. What's it like for you running a company in a competitive economy where it sounds like you're killing yourself to get a B? How do you keep going?
It's brutal. You and I have talked about how to stay fresh, how to exercise, breathe, learn to meditate, take more yoga. It's very, very stressful. It wears you down. And keeping your employees motivated, keeping their families safe and secure and confident is a full-time job. Mm-hmm. This economy is not for the faint of heart. This is tough.
Lisa Goldenberg is the president of the Delaware Steel Company of Pennsylvania. Lisa, thanks very much. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you. Take care.
Coming up.
It's so cold-blooded, it's so calculating, it's so utilitarian that it's not American.
Healthcare is a business, you know. But first, let's do the numbers. Whiplash much? The Dow Industrials delivered another head fake today. Climbed over 400 points early on, only to reverse into losing territory. The index closed down 1.25%, 204 points. Ended at 15,000, wait for it, 666. I'm just saying. NASDAQ having one of its best days ever, and then boom, down 0.4%, 19 points, finished at 4506. The S&P 500 threw off 1.33%, 25 points, closed at 1867. I figured, by the way, that we couldn't really do the wah-wah trombones 3 days in a row. That'd be too much. The tech sector looked a little bit like Best Buy on the day after Christmas, that is to say crowded for a while, and then the bargain hunters went home. Apple and Amazon were each up more than 4% during the session, but ended just 0.6% ahead. Netflix was yesterday's pain point, streamed up 9%, and then cut that gain in half, finished up about 4.5% today. Bond prices fell ever so slightly. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.07%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. A story now about business models, one very particular kind of business model, really. One built, in part, on hamburgers. As McDonald's watches its sales keep on sliding, it's coming under pressure from investors to start selling off some of its real estate. Catch is that franchisees paying rent has been a significant part of that company's income. So what to do? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer takes a look.
If you think things are tough for McDonald's now, imagine what it was like when the company was starting out. Banks didn't want to loan McDonald's money, so the Golden Arches transformed itself into a business the banks would lend to, sort of a real estate company, buying up restaurants and renting them to franchisees, one of the co-founders would say.
It's not a burger company. It's a real estate company that sells burgers.
That's Sam Okus. He's editor of QSR, a trade magazine for the fast food industry. He says this is a unique business model that gives McDonald's a lot of control over its franchisees.
And if they own that restaurant, they'll be able to dictate a lot more about the upkeep of the restaurant.
For example, McDonald's can give franchisees a break on the rent if they upgrade their stores. John Gordon is a restaurant analyst at Pacific Management Consulting Group. He says rent accounted for about a fifth of McDonald's worldwide revenue last year. He says the company would only sell under pressure from investors.
It's some activist investors looking for ways to juice the stock higher.
But others think the investors are right. McDonald's should sell. Take Don Snigowski. He's editor of Blue Mau Mau, a news site for franchise owners.
It would be good for McDonald's because McDonald's would have to focus on the food service business and not on real estate.
McDonald's refused our interview request, but a spokeswoman did say McDonald's will provide an update on financial areas of opportunity at its November investor meeting. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
These are not great days for coal. A couple of big coal producers are in bankruptcy protection. As a power source, it's been losing out to cheaper and cleaner natural gas for years now, to renewables as well. And those no clean air rules from the White House aren't doing it any favors either. Down in South Texas, though, right on the Mexican border, they're still digging. Officials and residents are arguing over a new coal mine from which all the coal is headed south. Ingrid Lobet reports.
Just outside the town of Eagle Pass, Texas, a subsidiary of a Mexican mining firm has bulldozed hundreds of acres of mesquite for a new mine. The coal here will stoke a smoky power plant half an hour south of the border. George Baxter, a civil engineer, says the smoke from that plant often drifts here to Eagle Pass.
If you see the brown line, horizontal line of pollution, it extends as far as the eye can see.
Is he surprised about a new American coal mine, what with now abundant natural gas and wind?
Apparently the war on coal does not extend to Maverick County.
And all for the greed of the excuse that we need energy. Well, this energy is going to Mexico.
That is Martha Bowles Baxter, the other half of the couple who has most dogged this mine effort. Fluent in Spanish, she tracks newspaper reports that depict coal-damaged towns across the border. She doesn't want her town to suffer the same coal dust and explosions. And they're not alone. David Salcedo is a county judge. He also wears the hat of floodplain administrator. He believes the mine should not be built because it's going to flood.
In 2013, we had 16 inches of rain in a 24-hour period. In 2014, we had 12 inches of rain in a 24-hour period.
So you had two 100-year floods in two successive years.
That's correct.
Those floodwaters entered 120 homes. The same creek that flooded now runs through the mine, with vegetation stripped on both sides. The fear is the next flood will carry mine mud or even mine waste. FEMA maps show the area is in the floodplain.
And when FEMA comes in, they're going to render that land completely contaminated, and those people are going to be losing all of their homesteads and what they plan to give to their children. And nobody seems to care because all of this area here is very, very poor and Hispanic.
Texas mining regulations require that the ponds that catch mud before it rushes into creeks be dug deep enough to withstand only a 10-year flood. But Rudy Rodriguez, who represents the mine owner, says the operation will actually reduce flooding and complies with numerous agencies' requirements.
Rules, regulations, policies, and procedures for the Texas Railroad Commission and everything that the legislators have put in place for us to operate under the laws of the state of Texas and the United States.
Already, Rodriguez says, hard-hit Maverick County is benefiting from the $60 million in equipment alone the mine has purchased.
This mine will be about $147.5 million initial economic impact into this community.
Out at the mine, he points to where a mechanic is changing a tire on a truck so large it makes his Cadillac Escalade look like a matchbox car. That tire alone, he says, cost $35,000. By one measure, at least, this mine has been popular, he says, when it held a fair to connect with local vendors.
We started at 8 o'clock in the morning, and we went on to into the evening. We couldn't stop. We just had so many people want jobs. 680 applicants for 100 jobs.
But at a federal hearing a couple of weeks ago, all 28 speakers, the mayor and officials from nearly every local agency, spoke against the mine. Judge Salcedo says most of the town would rather see retail jobs.
You had over 8,000 people sign a petition against the coal mine. To put that into perspective, you had 5,500 people come out and vote in the last general election. So when you have 5,500 people who vote and 8,000 that come out and sign a petition, you know, it shows you that there's an issue, you know.
Mine owners say they'll ship out the first load of coal next month, and they're asking for permission to make the mine five times bigger. In Eagle Pass, Texas, I'm Ingrid Lobet for Marketplace.
Ingrid Lobet is a reporter for Burn. That's from Sound Vision Productions with support from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. A moment now for something not coal or steel or the Chinese stock market for that matter, a little bit of Freakonomics. Stephen Dubner is the half of the Freakonomics duo that we talk to every month or so. Dubner, how are you?
Great, Kai. Thanks. How are you?
I'm all right. What do you got?
Well, you know, as you know, we sometimes explore ideas that most sane people would leave unexplored. In this case, we decided to look into the economics of end-of-life health care.
Wow. All right. So go. All right. This is going to have to be good because, whoa.
Well, we're calling it the glorious sunset proposal. So the idea is this. What if someone was suffering from a terminal illness and they had the option of foregoing standard end-of-life medical care, and instead you could get a cash rebate from their insurance company? So we actually made a fake commercial so you can hear how it might be pitched.
All right.
We all want to take care of mom.
But the doctor says her treatments might cost hundreds of thousands of dollars, and even so, she'll never fully recover. And we've got two kids to put through college.
Millions of families are struggling with these same decisions. Now, a new healthcare plan puts you in control. You can decide if medical treatments are right for you or your loved one. And if you decide to forego the standard treatment, we'll put the money directly in your pocket. Isn't it time for you to think about a glorious sunset? Enroll today.
Two things, Dubner. Number one, you're in the wrong business. You really should be in advertising because that was awesome. Number two, I don't know, man. I don't know.
Well, we decided to ask some people smarter than us what they thought of this idea. We started with the healthcare economist, Uwe Reinhart. We asked him if he would offer this option if he were, let's say, an insurance company CEO.
You know, I wouldn't, for the simple reason, what's in it for you? As an insurer, you are just passing through the hospital and doctor bills. You get a little margin on them. It's actually usually 3-5%. So your incentive is actually, in many ways, to increase health spending, right?
And this would not do that, right?
That's exactly right. Yeah. And beyond the economics, there's the optics of an idea like this, which are troubling.
It's so cold-blooded. It's so calculating. It's so utilitarian that it's not American.
I know that voice. Zeke Emanuel, he's a doctor, he's an ethicist. We've had him on the show, and he was one of the people who put together the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare.
Put together Obamacare and took a lot of heat for the death panel argument of Obamacare. So I asked him about that while we were talking about Gloria's sunset plan.
Well, let me clarify that.
Please do.
There was never, ever, ever in any draft of the Affordable Care Act anything about end-of-life care. It never made it into the draft. What ended up happening is that there were some ideas floated around and discussions had, and that people said, well, they're going to introduce death panels into the bill.
All right. So idea taken out of context, fair enough. But the point is he doesn't think much of Gloria Sunset, does he?
That's exactly right, Kaya. And Thomas Smith, who's a prominent oncologist at Johns Hopkins, he too was against the idea. And that's partly because he actually tried an experiment years ago that did this. It gave cancer patients the option to forego treatment and keep the money. That experiment failed. Here's one reason why.
Our patients were actually interested, but their doctor providers weren't. It's pretty hard to look at those two very different choices and decide what to do.
Which, by my count, makes it, 0 for 3 on this? Nobody likes Gloria Sunsets, right?
I'm 0 for 3. I'm 0 for 3. But I will say this. All three and more people that we spoke with did agree that if anything in our healthcare system really needs to be revolutionized right now, it's end-of-life treatment. And the economics is perhaps the least important part. Here's Zeke Emanuel again.
The healthcare system, you know, instead of talking to a patient and getting it right, we sort of pound on their chest and try to resuscitate them, even when that may not be what they want. And I think trying to get what patients want ought to be our primary focus.
And Kai, to Emanuel's point, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services has just proposed a regulation that would actually finally pay doctors to do nothing more than have a conversation with patients about their impending death.
The first step to glorious sunsets, right, Dodmer?
I don't know about the step to glorious sunsets, but it's certainly a step in the right direction, Kai. Absolutely.
Stephen Dubner of Freakonomics. They've got a podcast, a website, the whole deal. It comes out on Thursdays. You can check it on iTunes. Dubner, we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
Final note on the way out today, an indirect return to where we started, the idea that for as weird and as unsettling as the past week or so has been, and it has, this is not 2008 all over again. And I'll take that a step further right here. It's actually a good thing that the markets have let out some steam. We're working on a 6-year bull market right now, 6 years of virtually relentless gains. Are there things to worry about? Yes. Are we in a correction now with the three major indices? Also, yes. But nothing goes up all the time, forever. We forget that at our peril. All right, here's the recap for the day. And remember, big picture, please. All right, the Dow off 1.25%, 204 points. The NASDAQ down 0.4%, 19 points. The S&P 500 threw off about 1.3%, 25 points. Those all followed big rallies at the open. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner, the senior digital producer around here is Nishat Kurwa. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.